This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 10 days that reshaped U.S. finance is how the Wall Street Journal described the period that was capped with yesterday's emergency rescue of the insurance giant American International Group. The Federal Reserve will loan $85 billion to AIG, which is described in the New York Times today as the most radical intervention in private business in the Fed's history. Also in the past 10 days, the government took control of the failing mortgage finance companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, backing the $5.3 trillion of mortgages they own or guarantee. The government refused to bail out the 158-year-old investment bank Lehman Brothers, forcing it into bankruptcy. So what does all this mean for the American economy and for you and me? Back for a return visit is Michael Greenberger, who did a great job last spring on Fresh Air explaining the shadow financial system that he feels got us into this mess. Greenberger served on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission from 1997 to 99. He's now a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Michael Greenberger, welcome back to Fresh Air. What does it say that the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve were so worried about AIG going under that they bailed it out?
Well, what it says is that the economy is teetering on the brink. For the Federal Reserve and the Treasury to have gone from Sunday, Monday to saying they were no longer going to expose the U.S. taxpayers to bailouts after they effectively bailed out Bear Stearns in March and recently Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to within 24 hours have reversed positions on that, and now to have effectively taken over what was once the 18th largest corporation in the world. Evidence is the fact that the Fed and the Treasury are very, very worried about the stability of the economy. And when I say economy, I just don't mean fancy bankers sitting in Wall Street. They're worried about what this means to Main Street, about what it means to you and me. And in the absence of this rather dramatic move, I think they believe that we would enter something much deeper possibly than a recession and possibly a depression.
Why would AIG's failure have been such a disaster if they weren't bailed out by the government?
Well, essentially, AIG, which is a huge company, it's got a presence in 130 countries around the world, has a lot of successful businesses, like doing life insurance, annuities, commercial insurance, and the like, the kinds of things we expect a normal insurance company to do. But they then got into the business of essentially ensuring that all these financial instruments that are built around the hope that people who can't afford their mortgages will somehow be able to pay them, AIG ended up insuring those who wanted to invest in instruments that depended on those people paying their mortgages. They insured the fact that they would pay their mortgages. That is to say, if you were holding a mortgage for someone who was a risky creditor, if you were holding the financial instruments that are derived from the mortgages, the securities, the other derivative products, you're walking around telling the world, look, I know the subprime market has gone to hell in a handbasket, but don't worry about me. I have insurance. I have insurance, for example, with AIG. Well, if AIG collapsed, all those investors, those banks, those pension funds, those endowments, those hedge funds would suddenly no longer have insurance, and they would be exposed to what is happening in the economy regularly now, that these financial instruments dependent on people paying their mortgages would suddenly be next to worthless. So there would have been a cascading effect through the economy. It wouldn't just be AIG failing. It would be they would be bringing down many institutions with them.
So what would it mean to the rest of us who aren't directly connected to, you know, big financial institutions if AIG collapsed?
Americans would have suffered in two different ways. The first way would have been a lot of banks in which average Americans have their deposits have been telling their depositors and their shareholders that don't worry about us losing money because of the subprime meltdown. It's true we've had investments there and the investments have gone bad, but we've got insurance or a kind of insurance called credit default swaps from AIG and or companies like AIG. So even if we lose, we're hedged. Well, if AIG failed, all those banks would not be able to say that anymore. And even more pertinent, they would actually experience very steep losses. And they would end up being in the kind of financial trouble that Bear Stearns was in or Lehman Brothers were in or Washington Mutual. Now, the fact that banks fail in and of themselves means that they can't lend money to people who are going into business or students who need loans. That's one problem. Secondly, people in some of these banks take deposits. You have your checking account, your saving account in those banks. Now, a lot of people feel, well, so what if my bank fails? I'm insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation up to $100,000. Well, it turns out the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is already running low on money because it's had to insure deposits of banks that have already failed. And the head of the FDIC yesterday said, gee, I may need to go to the United States Treasury to borrow money because I'm running out of money to insure deposits. For that matter, you have trillions of dollars in deposits. The FDIC now has about $45 billion to cover their losses. So if banks start to fail, normal investors or depositors will have to go to the FDIC. The FDIC is running out of money. Now, clearly, the government will not allow that to happen in the long run. But how will they not let it happen? They'll raise taxes. You and I will have to pay more taxes to protect our deposits.
Then there's also a related issue of money market funds, which a lot of people have money in. They think it's very safe there. It's traditionally been very safe there. But what's the related danger to the AIG collapse?
Well, you're quite right. And with regard to money market funds, if a saver puts a dollar in to those funds, they expect to get a dollar back. They know they'll get a different interest rate, maybe high, maybe low, but they feel their dollar is safe. Many of those funds, it turns out, have investments in AIG. Either they hold bonds for AIG debt or they have equity interest in AIG. They hold their stock. And just yesterday, one of the very largest money market funds announced that they can no longer promise their depositors that their dollar is worth a dollar. They now say it's worth 97 cents. In the business, that's called, quote, breaking the buck, close quote. And the Fed and the Treasury were very worried that there'd be a widespread announcement to people who thought their money was very safe that, hey, that dollar isn't worth a dollar anymore. Maybe 97 cents, 95 cents, 85 cents. That would doubtless not only be a real problem, but would be a major psychological problem. It would hit a lot of people directly and immediately in their pocketbook. And as I said, one of the largest money market funds yesterday announced that it would break the buck. Others are lining up to do so. And if they can save AIG by this $85 billion loan, that will keep these money market funds intact. And the person on Main Street who may not be thinking about this or think it affects them will be, quote, kept in the dark. And that's especially important as we head into the election season.
Well, that leads me to ask, do you think that Henry Paulson, the head of the Treasury Department, and Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, are coming up with solutions for political reasons because of the election? I mean, do you think politics is affecting the approach that they're taking?
Well, to the extent that you say that if the average citizen discovers that he has a lot less money than he or she thought they have, yes, they will vote accordingly. But on the other hand, what they're really trying to prevent here in the first instance is a very serious economic crisis. And I mean, when back 6 months ago, people would say, well, this is almost like the Depression or it's a very serious problem like the Depression. People are now saying we are trying to avoid a depression. And if you remember history from the 1930s, one, people suffered economically in terrible ways during a depression. But secondly, it also revamped the American political system and brought about the New Deal and ended a long reign of Republican electoral victories. So there are two things working in tandem here. If we run into a very serious economic crisis, it will have a very steep impact on the way people think about how they vote. And you see that yesterday. Both campaigns are beginning to say, yeah, we need regulation. We need more regulation, especially startling in the case of John McCain, who has built a reputation as a person who believes in deregulation. So you can see this is all piling up. It is not just people on Wall Street losing their own money. It is not some distant problem that doesn't affect you and me. If AIG had failed, deposits would have been in jeopardy in savings accounts and checking accounts. Money market funds would have been in jeopardy. And also, by the way, a lot of people have insurance with AIG. They have life insurance or annuities. Now, the government is saying, oh, don't worry about that. These are in subsidiaries. They're very safe. It's the part of AIG that's in trouble is completely separate from that. But then we find out that when the government made the $85 billion loan, what did they use as the collateral from AIG? They used all these subsidiaries that sell life insurance, annuities, commercial insurance, et cetera. So that those assets are being sent around the table like playing cards. And those assets are your and my assets. There are a lot of people in this world. As I said, it was the largest private insurer in the world who are depending on insurance from AIG.
So have we averted the crisis?
Well, I think only time is going to tell. The AIG has gotten this $85 billion loan, and the question is going to be, will they be able to use it effectively to either right the ship so that they will be successful in the future, in which case, by the way, the taxpayer did get an 80% equity interest in the company. Or more likely what will happen is good news ending to this will but that it will be able to liquidate itself without exposing the economy to losses. Someone else will pick up the responsibilities that AIG has to the economy. But a danger is, and my own view is it's a 50-50 proposition, that even with $85 billion, we're going to give them $85 billion. It isn't going to work. They aren't going to save themselves. That money will be lost. Well, the government will say the good news is we have all this collateral. Well, that collateral are insurance contracts, life insurance contracts, annuities, commercial insurance. Is that the kind of collateral the American public wants to take? And what will it be worth? So it's, in my view, a 50-50 proposition as to whether this will work. And number two, this is AIG. Yesterday, it was Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers is going through a bankruptcy, which the government desperately tried to avoid because of the adverse consequences of that. But we look down the road. We see that Washington Mutual is having problems. Wachovia Bank is having problems. People may say, well, you know, those are problems in the future. But last week, people were saying, well, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, AIG, those are problems in the future. This week, they're immediate problems.
I guess I don't really understand where all this bailout money is coming from, since there's such a huge deficit that the American government has right now. How do we come up with the $85 billion to bail out AIG after the government has already bailed out Fannie and Freddie?
That's all. Well, first of all of that money is coming from the United States Treasury. And where does that money come from? It either comes from more borrowing from China and other foreign countries who are propping up the economy, or there's going to come a point where you just can't run up deficits anymore. That we now have a $5 trillion deficit. We entered into January 20th, 2001 with a multi-trillion dollar surplus. That's a $5 trillion deficit. The $85 billion will come out of the United States Treasury. And either we're going to fund that from China or you and I are going to have to pay for it through taxes. We assumed a $29 billion debt when we took over Bear Stearns. Now, the other thing I would say is the government in taking over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said, oh, we may spend $5 billion here or we may spend $200 billion there. But they've assumed a $5 trillion liability that is on the books, that is, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac guarantee of mortgages is a $5 trillion guarantee Before we took it over, that was a private obligation. Now it is a public obligation. And it effectively, you could argue, doubles the size of the national deficit. And that raises another interesting problem, is that the Bush administration refuses to treat these obligations as part of the national deficit. They want to sort of put it on a side sheet and forget about it.
So it wouldn't be counted as part of our national debt. It wouldn't be on the books.
Right. Well, at least so far as what you and I are told by our federal government. Mm-hmm. But the Congressional Budget Office is absolutely insisting, an independent, congressionally run auditing of the federal government is insisting that that be put on the books. And we ran into the same problem with the Iraqi war. They refused to put the billions of dollars we're spending a month in the Iraqi war into the same pile that is used to say how much money the United States owns. So, you know, this money isn't being printed. You and I are paying for it. We're either going to pay for it directly with taxes, or we're going to pay for it with interest payments to China.
I can't pretend to understand Wall Street, but it does, from my uninformed, distant view, look a little bit like maybe, you know, these institutions like Lehman Brothers, the big financial institutions, are unregulated. These new derivatives like credit default swaps are unregulated. But then when things start to fail, then the government jumps in and bails out as necessary. So it looks like it's unregulated until there's a big problem. Then it's more almost like socialism, where the government comes in and, you know, buys it or backs it. And it just seems to go from one extreme to another.
I think you've hit the nail on the head here. It's not that Lehman Brothers was totally unregulated. Parts of their business was regulated. Their broker-dealer operation, which, by the way, we hear today they're going to successfully be able to sell and save some jobs to Barclays Bank. But you're quite right. When I keep referring to the fact that all this bad investments were insured, what I'm really talking about, they don't really want to use the word insured. And what you'll see in the media is something that says it's insurance-like. Well, it really is insurance, and they don't want to use that word because insurance is regulated. These credit default swaps, which are another word for saying insurance, were deregulated by Congress essentially with absolutely no forethought given to it in December of 2000. These swaps, were they not expressly deregulated by federal statute, would either be regulated by state insurance commissioners or by the federal government as financial products that would be watched over. If it was insurance, or if it was, a futures trade, which would be subject to federal regulation, then if AIG would have had to have a capital reserve for all the insurance-like commitments it made. You're quite right. We went from a thing we said in 2000, hey, you know, have at it. This is wonderful. The free enterprise system, unburdened by the federal government. These people go out and they make ridiculous assumptions. That is, housing prices will always go up and I don't have to worry about commitments I make that you and I would have never allowed ourselves to make or our relatives to make. They make these assumptions under the so-called free market system. And where are we today? You're right. We're nationalizing these institutions. This is now your problem and my problem. We're undertaking the responsibility. And the sad fact is, what a lot of people are saying now, we privatize profits, we socialize losses. That is to say, if AIG were booming, nobody would ever say that you and I should have the opportunity to take it over. But when it collapses and threatens the entire economy, it becomes our problem. And the final point I would make, you say, well, when we have all these losses, we understand that we have to have a more government intervention. The only intervention here is taxpayer money to rescue these people. There's very little discussion about re-regulating the financial system so these so-called geniuses don't make these stupid investments based on concepts that you and I wouldn't let our children walk around talking about. And there's very little talk about let's go back and restructure these investments and re-regulate them. In fact, the investment banks today are saying, oh, yes, we got you in a lot of problem, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater by re-regulating us. My view is there's no baby here. There's no bathwater here. There's a swamp, and the swamp needs to be drained. And I worry whether our policymakers are up to understanding what needs to be done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the bailout of the insurance giant AIG, the financial crisis on Wall Street, and what that means for the economy and our personal finances. My guest is Michael Greenberger, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and the former director of the Trading and Markets Division of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. He teaches a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives called Hedging, Gambling, or Bankrupting the Economy. Now, throughout this interview, we've been talking about these complex financial instruments and, you know, the shadow financial system. The last time you were on Fresh Air, you did a great job explaining what some of these instruments were. I didn't want to take up too much time of our interview repeating what you said the last time, but I really would like you to take a couple of minutes here and give us an example of one of these complex financial instruments that you think should be regulated, that are behind a lot of the financial crisis that we're in now. One example of what it is and how it works.
Well, I think the poster child is the financial instrument that we've been talking about, credit default swaps. And just to quickly rehearse the bidding on all this, you have lenders who lent money to people who they knew probably couldn't afford to pay the money back and were assuming that because housing prices would go up, they eventually could refinance based on a higher price house. People took all those mortgages and bundled them into securities and then offered them to all sorts of financial institutions to buy the securities. Those securities were sliced and diced into different kinds of characteristics and then resold again as another set of securities. But essentially, everybody in that system was investing, if they were buying these products, in the fact that people who could not afford to pay their mortgages would somehow be able to pay their mortgages. Now, a lot of people, you might say, when they hear that financial proposition would say, why would they ever invest in people who seem to not be able to pay their mortgages, paying their mortgages? Well, the answer is they purchased credit default swaps, an insurance-like product. And in fact, it is insurance. So you've got people like AIG who go to these people who are worried about their investments and people who can't pay their mortgages and say, not to fear, let's insure it. You pay me a premium, and if they default on you, I'll give you all your money back. And of course, AIG, as I said earlier, thought this was risk-free. Housing prices always go up. People who can't afford their mortgages will be able to do so in 6 months. And this is just printing money. We're going to get premiums, premiums, premiums. Well, then suddenly when housing prices went down, they didn't have the money to pay the insurance obligation. They didn't have it because these things weren't treated like insurance products where they had to have a capital reserve that assured they could pay their obligations. They weren't treated like futures contracts that would have ensured that people who purchased or were selling this had adequate capital reserves and that they were marked to market every day. That is to say they had a value that was real, that could withstand accounting. So this was a system. And by the way, nobody's reporting this. Today, nobody knows how many of these credit swaps are out there. The government would die to have a list of who has credit default swaps and what are the obligations. They're private contracts, unregulated, and nobody keeps accounting for them. So you've got people like AIG, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, got into this business of ensuring that people who couldn't afford their mortgages would pay their mortgages. Now, you know, if there were a regulator involved in all that, they would have said, are you crazy? You're getting in this a business without setting aside capital reserves, and you're ensuring that people who haven't documented their assets will pay off their mortgages? That's a business we as a regulator would advise you to enter into very cautiously. Well, there was none of that, no adult supervision. It was, in fact, barred by the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which was passed in the dead of night as Congress was recessing for Christmas in December of 2000. It was pronounced that this deregulation would be a boon to the American economy, and look where we are now. So those credit default swaps are those complex financial instruments for which there is no oversight on the federal and state level. There is no oversight because it's expressly barred by congressional statute. And what we allowed these banks to do, and by the way, the people who are doing these trades, they aren't the adults within the banking system. There's a whole sales force of young people who are getting commissions off making these trades. And the guys and gals who are running the shop don't understand what's happening. And by the way, I've not mentioned here that a lot of these products were rated AAA by the credit rating agencies. Why were they rated AAA? Because when a credit rating agency gives a rating, they're paid by the people who own the financial instrument. They're biased. They want to satisfy those people.
So now that Lehman Brothers has gone under and is going to be in bankruptcy, and now that the government has taken over the AIG insurance company, will the shadow financial system be put in the light? Will we be learning things about what's happening in these secret derivatives and fancy financial instruments?
Well, certainly you can see, if you're reading day by day what's happening here, is the government is desperately trying to avoid putting anybody through bankruptcy. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in a conservatorship. AIG is in a conservatorship. And the reason they fear bankruptcy is that a lot of these complex financial instruments are sitting on various books and haven't been tested by economic reality. They aren't traded on a regular basis. And quite simply, if I'm holding, for example, a mortgage-backed security or some offshoot of a mortgage-backed security, or for that matter, a credit default swap, essentially each institution that holds it are left to their own devices to say what it's worth. They get in auditors and mathematicians, but it's blue smoke and mirrors, and they're making their own evaluations. The reason the government has been trying to avoid a bankruptcy is, for example, Lehman Brothers, these products, these instruments, are now going to have to be tested in an adversary system with economic experts looking at them, and these instruments will suddenly have a very clear value. And that will not only, I believe, be a problem for the creditors of Lehman Brothers, because we're going to find out these assets are worth a lot less than Lehman Brothers has been telling people they're worth, but if you suddenly take a kind of asset and say, well, the world believed that this was worth 85 cents on the dollar, and then you go through bankruptcy and find out it's worth 9 cents on the dollar, that asset starts having a generalized value. And people who aren't involved in the Lehman bankruptcy, who are holding those assets in their portfolios, are suddenly going to find out what they've been telling the world is worth 85 cents is worth 30 cents, 25 cents. Well, what does that mean? That means all these institutions are suddenly going to have to report more losses, and they're going to go into a chaotic spin. And if the government believes their spin, like AIG's, will adversely affect the economy, the incentive will be to go out and rescue them too, using taxpayer money or borrowing from China and having us pay the interest on it. So the reason that bankruptcy, everybody's saying, great, we finally didn't bail somebody out. We're going to let these guys suffer, go through bankruptcy, and no bailouts for them. Well, the problem with that is, and why the government doesn't want to do it, is Paulson and Bernanke know that the assets Lehman Brothers are holding are worth a lot less than they're telling the world. And there will be a system for telling the world what those assets in general are worth. And everybody else who's holding those assets will have to fess up that their financial statements are a lot worse than what they've been telling the shareholders and the public.
So what happens to all the money that's been lost? I mean, you know, we're putting $85 billion just into AIG, and then there's Fannie and Freddie. Money doesn't just, like, disappear into the ether, or maybe it does. Like, where is all that money that's been lost?
Well, I mean, a lot of this money was promises based on the fact that there was no money there to begin with. For example, I could promise you I'm going to pay you $1 million at the end of the day, and you could say, great, and go to the bank and say, I have an asset for $1 million and ask the bank to loan you $2 million. And then at the end of the day, you come to me and I say, sorry, Terry, I thought I had the million, but I don't. And then the bank is going to come back to you they borrow the money from and say, where's your money? And you may ask, where are all those losses from? But the losses were built on the fact that the money wasn't there to begin with.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, this like shadow financial system that we've been talking about that's unregulated, that isn't traded on the stock exchanges, how does that compare in size to the amount of money that is traded on the stock exchanges?
Well, first of all, because it's opaque, and that is to say nobody writes down, there's not a central registry of all these transactions. You can't tell. And as I have said, the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Fed would dearly love to have that registry in the sky that tells them where all these time bombs are located. But the estimates are, for example, in the credit derivative market, which we've talked about, is estimated to be $62 trillion. And that exceeds all the money in stocks. It exceeds all the money in bonds. It's a huge, huge. It's not some little sideshow. It's become the predominant method of transacting businesses in the economy. And in fact, that's why I teach this course at the law school, because I think young lawyers should be armed to understand this. And I think I'm one of the few law professors in the country that tries to explain this. Most law schools are back still worried about stocks and bonds, but nobody's losing money because the person who sells stocks and bonds is going out of business. The stocks and bonds may be losing money. But in this environment, people don't know what they're doing in their financial strategies. And as I've said, they're claiming they have money when they don't. And you need to have people in our professional systems who understand this.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Greenberger, and he directed a division of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in the late 1990s. He's now a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. And among the things he teaches is a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives, hedging, gambling, or bankrupting the economy. We're just a few weeks away from the presidential election. Let's look at where Obama and McCain stand on what's been called the shadow financial system that we've been talking about. Let's start with McCain.
Well, McCain essentially has taken two different approaches, one of which worries me a great deal because it plays off of ideas of the Bush administration and especially Secretary Paulson. You know, everybody now, all the politicians are saying, oh, we need more regulation. We need reform. This is just awful. We've let this thing, we've dropped the ball. One kind of regulatory reform that they're talking about is sort of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. What I mean by that is they're saying, well, the SEC can't quite handle this kind of thing, so we're going to merge the SEC with the CFTC and have the SEC operate more like the CFTC, and we're going to take some powers from them, and we'll give some to the Treasury, and then we'll give a lot of powers to the Federal Reserve, and this will be a modern regulatory system. Well, as you'll notice in that description, there's nothing in there about the underlying derivative products that caused the problem. They just want to just change the organizational chart, and to the extent there's any substantive content to it, it's to make it easier for the Federal Reserve to do these bailouts. It's the equivalent of saying, we're not going to put a door on the barn to keep the horse in, but we're going to get faster people to chase the horses after they've left. And there's very little talk on the part of McCain about, wow, we have some pretty devastating products that we deregulated here in the Republican Congress in the late, in 1999, 2000. And now we need to figure out how to staunch the bleeding. And of course, my answer would be, we talked about credit default swaps. It's really insurance, but not regulated like insurance. They're really futures contracts, but not regulated like futures contracts. In fact, they're not regulated at all. And so one quick answer would be, hey, let's stop having these credit default swaps issued or these other derivative products. going into this deregulatory phase, they were either regulated or arguably regulated. Let's go back to the status quo ante. You're hearing more of that from Obama, although I would like to hear it said in a more direct fashion. And I would add in that regard, Obama has, as part of his advisory team, Robert Rubin, who was the Secretary of the Treasury for a good part of the Clinton administration. Now, Robert Rubin and I had our differences in the Clinton administration. I was very worried about this and argued strenuously that all these products have some regulatory format around them, that we know where they are, that they be adequately capitalized, that they be margined properly, and other traditional techniques. And Robert Rubin and his successor, Lawrence Summers, were not sympathetic to that point of view. And that's all fine and dandy, but Robert Rubin now is articulating the fact that he has learned from this experience, and he is saying that these complex financial products need to be transparent. We need to know where they are, who has them, what the value is. We need to make sure that if somebody makes a commitment, they have an adequate capital reserve. We need to have margin requirements. We need to audit these things to make sure that they have a real value that can withstand economic reality. And it's for that reason, as I look out and see what's happening, I would say that Obama and his advisors have a better bead on what the problem is. Although, I must say, both from both campaigns and from Congress as a whole, I really believe that there's a little bit too much of being behind the curve on this. And I think they're struggling to sort of articulate what it is they want to do. But I think Obama's got a better bead on what the problem is.
So, Michael Greenberger, you've painted a pretty dire picture of the American economy, and you're not at all confident things are going to get better very soon. So, just to bring this down to the micro level, and we only have a few seconds left, what's the safest thing to do with your money right now?
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm not completely pessimistic because I think there are strategies that can get us out of this mess.
Good. Leave us on an optimistic note.
I don't want to have people listening to this say, oh, my gosh, the world is coming to an end. First of all, the government will bail out a lot of things. We may have to pay through it through taxes and interest payment on loans to other governments, but I think people will be bailed out in the short run. And I think there is an intelligent path, but we need intelligent leadership to lead us through that path to get us out of this mess. And as to what people should do with their money, I'm completely unqualified to answer that question. My advice to people is to search out a competent, and I underline the word competent, certified financial advisor to get advice on where to handle your money. I am worried about the FDIC's depleting its resources, but I'm confident that Congress will not allow it to run out of money. So I don't advise, I think I don't advise putting money in your mattress. The only option is to put it in an insured account. And I think people should just be wise about what institutions they decide to use, even if they believe that their money is insured.
Michael Greenberger, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Michael Greenberger is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and a former member of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. You can download podcasts of our interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. Hold Up the Sky is Andy Zwirling's first solo album in 37 years. A former rock critic who has made his living as a lawyer for decades, Zwirling has also steadfastly maintained a sideline as a songwriter, writing and recording literally thousands of songs that have not been released. Rock critic Ken Tucker thinks Zwirling's new Hold Up the Sky is something special.
It's a terribly wonderful place. this one.
Andy Zwirling makes carefully crafted pop songs designed to sound like journal entries. Spontaneous thought, sudden inspiration that is in fact meticulously labored over. At his best, you can be startled by his "this just popped into my head" immediacy. Like, Andy, did you actually just write a song about watching TV and seeing Jenny Lewis, singer with the band Rilo Kiley, and have a little TV crush on her? I think you did.
TV news will hit hard. Naked twinkling dim stars. The only one I truly love is someone else's wife. Jenny Lewis is live on TV tonight. Jenny Lewis is live on TV tonight.
There are people we can love.
I have my own tiny part in the Andy Zwirling saga. In the late 70s, when I worked for a now-defunct newspaper in Los Angeles, I reviewed a then-unreleased demo tape that Andy recorded with his sister Leslie as an additional lead vocalist. But as Andy, himself an ex-rock critic for Rolling Stone, knows all too well, the power of the press doesn't extend to star-making. And it wasn't until 1980 that an album called Opportunity Rocks, and credited to Andy and Leslie Z, was released to instant cult status. Which is a polite way of saying Andy went back to being a lawyer most of the time. In 2001, my Fresh Air colleague Ed Ward wrote a big piece about Andy for the New York Times Arts and Leisure section. Again, nada, at least commercially.
Southern fried, drifting snow clouds side. Blame the union, who's ever. Anticipation rings, but my laughter strained. They might be giants, it's a super game. There are losses that ought to be gained. I miss the sound.
It's not difficult, really, to hear why Andy Zwirling is not competing with the Jonas Brothers in iTunes downloads. He makes music whose melodies offer fresh variations on 50s doo-wop, 60s pop, and 70s singer-songwriters. He sings in a full-throated, open-hearted manner. No Clay Aiken melismatics for our Andy. But what I like most about Zwirling is his fearless emotionalism, the way he really commits to the big, unironic sentiments in his songs.
A dark star and shine its light. I will still be close to you here in my heart. Dear in my heart, there's always a place.
On TV Pizza, the song that led off this review, Zwirling sings, "This world is a terribly wonderful place." That word terribly is placed carefully in there to acknowledge the pain in the wonderfulness. Yet you also don't doubt for a moment that he really does think the world is pretty terrific. Let's hope it doesn't take another few decades before we hear more of Andy Zwirling's unique wonderment.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly.